This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
When you do a program covering health, occasionally you deal with certain topics that make people a bit squeamish. Things like digestive health and reproductive and sexual issues and body image. They're not the type of thing you rush right off to your doctor to discuss.
They are uncomfortable, and I have to remind them, this is what I do every day. I've seen a lot worse than yours.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to a pair of doctors who specialize on these taboo topics. We'll also learn how, and sorry to our vegetarian friends, that sometimes keeping a healthy diet begins with healthy livestock. And we'll visit a city in Italy where fast food could mean a spleen sandwich. Dr. Nina Sachs is away this week. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Nobody's in a big hurry to go to the doctor and talk about urine leakage. And when was the last time you thought, I can't wait to see the doc and talk about my saggy breasts? I'll admit, that's the first time I've ever said that sentence out loud. The point is, there are things about our bodies we don't feel comfortable talking about, but they need to be talked about. And that's what we're going to do right now. Joining me is Dr. David Kimball, Chief of Urogynecology and Pelvic Reconstructive Surgery at Albany Medical Center here in Albany, New York. We also have Dr. Malcolm Roth, Chief of the Division of Plastic Surgery at Albany Med. Well, Dr. Kimball, first, do you think it's easier for patients to talk to you about these things rather than their regular doctor?
Oh, yeah, by far. I think they're much more comfortable when they come in and see a specialist to say, this is why I am here. This is what this person does for a living, so I'm not as intimidated. So I agree with you, Bob.
Okay. And for plastic surgery, do you think maybe it's a little embarrassing for their regular doctor and once they get to you, it's like, okay, I'm with a friendly face now?
Well, it's actually even embarrassing for them to come into our offices, although they know they're in to talk about perhaps their breasts or their body. When you ask them to take off their clothing, put on a gown, and then to take the gown off so you can properly examine them, they are uncomfortable. And I have to remind them, this is what I do every day. I look at breasts, I look at bodies, and whatever you have, I've seen probably a lot that are a lot more embarrassing or a lot worse than yours. So don't be shy. This is what you're here for. Let's talk about what we can do to make you happy about the way you look.
Now, when it comes to plastic surgery, how much is done that is, you know, medically necessary, say reconstruction after breast surgery, and how much is just, you know, I've been wanting to do this all my life, I want it now?
That's a great question, and I think it's important to know the difference. Reconstructive surgery is taking something that's abnormal and trying to make it more normal. Cosmetic surgery is defined as something that's normal and trying to enhance it to make it better, to make it look better. Reconstructive surgery is often for functional improvement. And plastic surgeons do both types. In fact, over 90% of the members of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons do both cosmetic and reconstructive surgery. In terms of how much is cosmetic and how much is reconstruction, it's probably about 75% is reconstructive surgery. And only about 25% of the surgery that's done is cosmetic. Although we have many non-surgical options now for enhancement that are injections, lasers, other types of modalities that don't require a knife. So if you look at everything that we do, it's probably about 50% cosmetic.
How much of that is now done by dermatologists?
Well, that's a great question. And we've actually tried very hard to educate our patients as to who they should be going to, because the reality is that in most states, any physician can say, I'm a plastic surgeon. There are only four states that I'm aware of that have legislation that says if you advertise that you're board certified, you have to say what the board certification is in. So there are dermatologists that do some aspects of plastic surgery, and they do it very well. Injections of neurotoxins like Botox and Dysport, fillers. They may even do some liposuction, but dermatologists are not who you should be going to for your breast augmentation or for your tummy tuck or for many other things. So I think it's important for everybody to do their homework because of all that white coat confusion and make sure that the person really is trained in plastic surgery. And the easiest way to do that is go to plasticsurgery.org, and everybody there is a member of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons.
Now, Dr. Kimball, when someone comes into your office and is embarrassed to talk about something, usually it's quality of life and possibly, you know, of something that might be life-threatening. Do you have to, like, pull stuff out of people? Okay, no, what's really going on here?
Well, usually people start off with surface issues, and then you kind of delve deeper into where the problem comes from, what other peripheral issues occur with them, and then you can get to the crux of the issue. But most people don't walk in and say, you know, I have my uterus between my legs and I can't walk and run and do the things I want to do. They'll come in and say, well, my doctor told me to come over because I feel a little bit of pressure and discomfort, and they thought you better look at it and tell me what's going on, what I need to do.
There are so many different functions that your specialty deals with. What do you deal with the most?
Primarily prolapse and incontinence. So if you look at what women really deal with, very few women have issues related to their ability to have a bowel movement. And there's a certain segment of the population that does have that issue. So I don't want to undermine the importance of it. But more commonly, we see bladder-related issue. I leak when I walk or sneeze or cough or laugh. I feel like something's bulging and coming out that should not be there and should not be coming out. And that's primarily what we deal with, the bladder, cervix, uterus, vagina. And of course, the rectum is there, but most of the time, once we correct those other issues, the rectum does fine.
Is this something that's usually older people, or do you deal with many young people on this?
Well, you know, Bob, if you look at the age range of women I have operated on for pelvic organ prolapse with the Da Vinci robot, it goes from 26 years of age to 89 years of age. Hmm. So the vast majority of women will fall into the mean of about 58 to 60 years of age. So it does affect a younger population at times.
Are most of the people who come in, are they referred to you by their physician, their usual general practitioner, or is it something where they had another treatment and, well, you're the next in line to talk to them about something?
Well, frankly, both. The vast majority of women come in because they're referred by their primary care physician or gynecologist who says, you know, this is an issue that's above and beyond what I'm comfortable correcting surgically, and I really want you to see a subspecialist. Other people come in because they've had corrective surgery done, as we've gotten many calls on, that said it didn't work, or I'm still back in the same boat again, and it's been only a few years, and they're looking for different alternatives. What else can be done or should be done?
Here's a question that I cannot ask you, but I can ask Dr. Roth.
Feel free to do so.
We spoke a lot about what women want. What is it that men come to you to see?
Well, many of the same things that women come to us for. Start at the area that's the most popular for women, breast augmentation. Well, actually, men sometimes come to us for what we call pectoral implants. If they're wanting to have a more defined chest, it's not a common procedure, but they do actually come to us for that. But they more commonly will come for facelifts, eyelid tucks, blepharoplasty is what we call it, lipoplasty. They'll come to us for tummy tucks. And now more and more patients who've had massive weight loss after bariatric surgery or simply getting better in their choices of what they're going to put in their mouths and eat, they get more serious about their exercise and they've lost 100 pounds or more. We're finding, just like the women, we're doing body contouring procedures to try to remove and tighten the loose skin, abdomen, back, buttocks, arms, the neck, the breasts. So it's really all over the place. Of course, men also do sometimes come in for hair transplant surgery.
How much is covered by insurance of what you do?
Well, the reconstructive surgery is all covered, and that is the majority of what most plastic surgeons do. Sure. Cosmetic surgeries, if it's simply to make something look a little better, it's probably not. But there are gray areas. Breast reduction certainly is an area that you're enhancing somebody's appearance, but you're also helping their function, and so that usually is covered. What about nose jobs? And both men and women come to us to have their noses fixed. To try to improve the cosmetic appearance of the nose is cosmetic, but in order to help them breathe better, that portion is reconstructive. And sometimes a portion of the operating room fee and a portion of the anesthesia fee would be covered if it is reconstructive in nature.
When it comes to the removal of that skin after bariatric surgery, are there portions of that, and I had heard this, that portions of that are covered and portions of it aren't?
It depends on the individual. It depends just how symptomatic they are. There are many people who've lost so much weight that the skin is hanging over their belt. They have skin breakdown, rashes, bleeding, pain. inability to just walk from the extra skin hanging in their inner thighs. And so if it's affecting their function, then that is something that a plastic surgeon will work with the patient to try to make sure the insurance company recognizes that it's reconstructive and pays for.
Okay. And you mentioned breast reduction surgery, and you've told me that that is probably the most satisfied customer you have is a breast reduction patient.
Yes, it's women with large breasts. They suffer terribly from adolescence, usually, on until they finally say, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. They have shoulder pain from the bra straps digging into their shoulders, trying to support their breasts. They have upper back pain, maybe lower back pain, neck pain. They can have rashes from the undersurface of the breast. So it really is a problem. And when we do the breast reduction, we change their lives.
Dr. Kimball, what's the one question I didn't ask that you're going, I wish he'd asked me this?
Well, probably the one question didn't come up is, what is the future in treatment of prolapse and those kind of issues? We touched a little bit upon da Vinci surgery, and why is it that we have this big issue in our country with the mesh material? You go turn on any station, any hour of the day, you'll see, call one of those lawyers saying, if you've ever had mesh put in the vagina, if you've had or ever had incontinence surgery, prolapse surgery, call us because there's issues with that. And how are we going to overcome that? How are we going to make sure women still get treated, get appropriate correction of their issue, and not have to deal with some of the complications related to the use of mesh material? And what does the future hold? That's where the da Vinci surgery comes into play, because this really approaches it at the core of the issue that caused it. So we're not trying to put separate graft in an area where it's not the primary cause of the prolapse. We're recreating the normal ligaments that women lost over the years and resuspend everything back to where it was originally located. So that's really where the future of this field is going.
Same question to you. What haven't we touched on that you really think is important for people to know?
Well, I think we touched on it briefly, but I'd like to elaborate a little bit. And that's, how do I find the right plastic surgeon? How do I know this is the right one to go to? Unfortunately, cosmetic surgery is often an impulse purchase. This is not like going to the mall and deciding you want to buy some stockings. You need to do your homework, just as you would before you buy a car. You wouldn't drive away out of the parking lot of a car dealer without checking that the car is safe, that it has a good resale value and you've gotten your best price. You wouldn't buy a house without getting it inspected to make sure the plumbing and electricity are fine. So going to the plastic surgeon that your next door neighbor's Aunt Tessie said was a nice guy isn't doing your homework. This is a serious decision. If you choose poorly, you're going to potentially end up paying a lot more to fix the problem. You might not even be able to fix the problem, and you could even die. And that is happening from people not doing their homework. So choose wisely. Make sure it's a board-certified plastic surgeon. PlasticSurgery.org is a good place to start your shopping.
Dr. David Kimball is Chief of Urogynecology and Pelvic Reconstructive Surgery at Albany Medical Center. And Dr. Malcolm Roth is Chief of the Division of Plastic Surgery at Albany Med here in Albany, New York. Still to come, sometimes a healthy diet starts before food is even food. That's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1252. This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett. For livestock producers, keeping animals healthy can make or break their business. But people have a lot of opinions and concerns these days about how they get the job done. So Jessica Najunas from Harvest Public Media visited with beef and dairy farmers to ask about today's Scarlet A, antibiotics, and how they fit into their healthy cow equation.
Chuck Massengill owns 50 head of cattle in California, Missouri. He raises the beef cows on rolling fields of green grass.
What we're looking at right now is a group. This group has 25 black cows. Three of them are red, white face, and the others are black, white face. And they've all been born since September the 6th.
They spend their lives under his care out on pasture, and they're free to roam where they like. But Massengill's laissez-faire herd management style ends when it comes to animal health.
We vaccinate for production concerns, and we vaccinate for life and death concerns.
Vaccinations, for example, can help prevent things like bovine trichomoniasis, a venereal disease that can shut down a herd's productivity. It's a growing concern in cattle country, and Missouri now requires ranchers to test for trich before a bull is rented or sold for breeding. The point is, for many cattle ranchers, a preventative approach is an essential part of a conventional ranching business.
If we have a good vaccination prevention program, then we reduce the likelihood we're going to have to use antibiotics to treat the animals.
Antibiotic use is quite the contentious issue among farming groups and consumers. Massengill says the issue comes up because of what he sees as confusion over antibiotic use. He says farmers aren't constantly injecting their cows with antibiotics. On most farms, the use is pretty low.
If a calf gets diarrhea, I'll give it antibiotics specifically to treat that diarrhea. This year, we've not had a single case. Last year, I treated maybe two or three.
The cows we're standing near haven't been treated with drugs, and there are many reasons not to. They're expensive, after all, Massengill says, and if they're treated too close to slaughter, the animals are not suitable to enter the food chain.
I certainly can't imagine antibiotic coming through en masse in beef products. I just can't even imagine that.
But some people can imagine it and avoid conventionally raised meat altogether. There's also been particular concern among activists about antibiotics showing up in milk and other dairy products. Chris Hines is the dairy herd manager for Hines Family Dairy in Higginsville, Missouri. The dairy produces 6,000 gallons of milk a day, but he says they've managed to keep their vet bill low.
So much of that just has to do with how you design the barns and then just treating the animals well.
Hines also practices preventative measures to keep his cows healthy, and he says he can do that by cutting down on stress the animals may experience, proper ventilation, the right nutritional balance on feed, access to plenty of clean water, and giving the cows space to move around helps.
I only try to use antibiotics whenever it's necessary for the health of the animal. You know, our cows, you know, don't have health insurance, and you know, antibiotics aren't cheap.
To treat one average-sized cow with penicillin, it might cost over $500 by the end of the antibiotic regimen. Hines says even if he drops the cash and uses antibiotics, it's not like the cows continue to be milked for human consumption.
Her milk will not enter the rest of the milk. It will not get shipped to the store or anything like that. So as soon as any cow gets antibiotics, she will get moved to a separate pen.
So what's the worry? Well, some say there's a danger in overuse of antibiotics. Regular doctors don't prescribe antibiotics to sick people unless it's really needed. Too many antibiotics thrown at bacterial infections could create a super-resistant pathogen. So the idea is if a cow is pumped up with antibodies, even when it isn't sick, that stripped clean environment, the meat, would not be safe to eat. The concern is growing around the world. The European Union has banned the use of antibiotics for growth promotion, a type of treatment that requires constant administering of antibiotics. But to ban the use of all of the drugs, as some food activists want, would only cause bigger problems, many in the animal health industry argue.
We're finding more and more the importance of the healthy animal for food safety.
Scott Hurd is a veterinarian at Iowa State University. He says an animal that looks perfectly healthy at slaughter and passes inspections could have undetected lesions or signs of infection and be unsafe to eat.
Those animals are more likely to be contaminated with salmonella with campylobacter. The data are showing us that there's an increased contamination rate. The healthy animal on the farm is directly related to public health.
There's legislation that's been in the works since 2009 that would eliminate growth-promoting antibiotics for use in the U.S., but the proposal wouldn't ban antibiotics used to treat illness. Still, traditional livestock groups are on the alert and want to avoid regulation when it comes to animal health. The bill has stalled in Congress, and the groups have lobbied legislators with this thought. Giving the farmer fewer options to manage animal health on the farm means less food safety for the consumer. Jessica Najunas, Harvest Public Media.
In the capital of Sicily, Palermo, fast food is available on nearly every corner with nary a golden arch in sight. Sicilians devour what they call street food at affordable prices for a population that's struggling to get by. One in every three Sicilians lives below the poverty level. Many fill their bellies with chickpea fritters, fried rice balls, and even spleen sandwiches. Reporter Nancy Greenlease searched the streets of Palermo for the perfect spleen sandwich.
Drivers tear around Palermo's port, passing boats with white masts poking into the sky. The deep blue sea may offer a bountiful feast, but the drivers screech to a halt at Panica Miausa. That's the name of the tiny joint and also the type of sandwich this family-run business has sold for nearly seven decades. Gaetano Favata stands behind the counter, stirring a silver vat filled with the organ meat.
Are you going to eat one?
If you like Palermo, you have to eat a spleen sandwich.
Well, this certainly isn't spaghetti or pizza. Yet Sicilians are believed to have eaten this organ sandwich since the Middle Ages. Favata has worked here since he was 15 and knows his beloved sandwich has been around much longer than his 52 years.
For centuries, centuries, since this is a dish that originated with the Jews, truly with the Jews.
Or so many say, but it's not well documented. In Palermo, many Jews worked as butchers. Some think they invented the inexpensive sandwich.
This is how spleen sandwiches started, and as the years have passed, they've evolved into these exquisite snacks. But way back when, people ate the sandwich to stave off hunger. The rich were not eating these sandwiches.
The wealthy got the best cuts of meat, and most other Sicilians made do with the rest. Spleen sandwiches are still considered pretty cheap, but these days everyone eats them. To make one, the cow's spleen is cleaned, boiled, and cooled. The organ ends up looking like a lean steak. This is where Favata's work begins.
Cut little slices of the spleen, three slices. You put them in the pan. You cook them slowly over a low flame. See the lard in the vat? We let the slices heat up for just a few minutes.
Favata grabs a crusty round roll that's soft inside to better absorb the juices. With the other hand, he dips a flat ladle into the vat and pulls up a pile of fried spleen that he delicately places on the open roll. You'd think he was doling out caviar instead of a Sicilian sloppy joe.
We put a little salt on it, a squirt of lemon. We put paper around it, add a napkin, and give it to the customer, and you can eat it. Eat it. I'm telling you in the Palermo dialect to mangia.
Assa mangia.
Eat it.
Mangia. Assa mangia.
I obey, chewing the tender meat that shames those two all-beef patties.
Mmm. It's very, very good. The meat is a little bit salty. Obviously fresh and well-chosen meat. Buonissimo. Complimenti. Complimenti.
Some top the sandwich with ricotta, or the local caciocavallo cheese. Favata is convinced spleen sandwiches are healthy. He points to an article framed on the restaurant's tiled wall that backs him up. Granted, cooking a spleen in lard boosts the cholesterol level, but at $2.30, at least the price won't give you a heart attack. Another customer double parks and dashes in to pick up a few sandwiches.
You see? And he's off. It's fast food that's very fast. You order it, eat it, hop in the car, and take off. You're in and out, in and out. That's why it's wonderful, truly fantastic.
I'm Nancy Greenlace in Palermo.
And Nancy's story comes to us courtesy of the World Vision Report. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org. Dr. Nina Sachs will be back with us next week. I'm Bob Barrett. Till next time, stay healthy and be sure to join us for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.